Okay. If you're, I tell you what, we'll leave it open, and if somebody can't hear, they can go over with attitude and close it. And that'll tell us. Then. So I think we were at the 1928 election was where we last covered. And what had occurred that I thought was of interest in that election? If I can find my material.
Southern states voted Republican.
Yes, Southerns, not all of them, but a sizable number of them. And it wasn't just Arkansas that stayed Democratic. Some stayed Democratic, some voted Republican. But it was the first time since ever that Southern states voted Republican, since the creation of the Republican Party. And would be the last time again until Eisenhower of the 50s before Southern states would do that. So that illustrated the attitude towards Catholics, and it also suggests why the Klan would make Catholics as part of their target in the 20s and 30s. It may tell us also something about the 1960 election, which I think we've alluded to before, is that when JFK became the first Catholic candidate for the Democratic Party, one of the first things he had to do was appear before a gathering of Baptist ministers in Houston to promise repeatedly he would follow the Constitution rather than the Pope once he was elected. And at that point, then the Southern Democrats connected to the Baptist churches would be allowed to vote for Kennedy, and so that was the purpose of the meeting. So Al Smith's candidacy, or his Catholic background, is definitely what hurt his candidacy. And Hoover won the election, but Hoover probably would have won anyway, even if the Southern states had all stayed loyal to the Democratic Party, because Hoover had the image of being the one who had brought the prosperity to the 20s. And that was, as Secretary of Commerce, he was definitely associated with that success story in economics. The irony of it all is that shortly after, within almost like Bush's situation, if you think about it, the number of months, because it was October, it was close to September, that the stock market crashed. And with that, everything changed around in a hurry, and no longer did Hoover seem to have that assurance, because there was a lot of jitteriness in the first 2 weeks of the crash. In previous crashes, the best example would be in 1908, which is a crash we don't even remember, because it was the solution I'm going to give here is that people like J.P. Morgan and Fisk and others had invested heavily into the market for 2 weeks straight in order to make sure that prices of stocks did not fall, and it worked. It kept the market up. So that same effort was being taken in 1929, but did not work, and disastrously wiped those people out who tried it. And when I think about the stock market crash and try to find a way to introduce that into how a lesson we can get from it, there was a 1987 stock market crash. I don't know if anybody recalls that, but in points and in amount of properties lost, it was worse than the two that occurred on the Thursday and Tuesday in 1929. But there wasn't a corresponding depression for a decade, from 1987 to 1997. So how do you assess that? How does the stock market crash that is worse in 1987 lend itself to no depression, and the one in 1929 does? Yes, that's the answer. That's exactly it. Is that the programs initiated in the 1930s to cope with the depression and to prevent future problems such as this to happen worked? So If this means you or your family members, this is not a good statement, but the point I'm going to make is the people who lost money in the 87 crash had real money to lose. They could afford to lose it. Where so much of the money lost in the 29 crash was artificial from credit abuse. And that's where we're at on number 28 on my sheets of the next page. Are they for you too? Are they at the top of your page? Okay. So when looking at the Great Depression and how the crash figures in, most historians put a lot of trust in the book by John Kenneth Galbraith, The Great Crash, where he outlines the causes or the links that take it to depression. And you can still hear me? I hear cars whooshing back and forth. But should I close this? Okay. Up in Bentonville, and I'm just thinking, all my college money is spent and gone. I can't go into any other profession. I wish I could just keep going out this door. But it got better.
I'm just thinking about us that are going to that
Yeah. Get a little experience with it before you commit yourself totally. And that's too late already. But. Well, I just discovered that junior high and high school kids just didn't appreciate the pontification that I had to give. There's pearls of wisdom, I thought, and they sure didn't seem to see it that way. Didn't mean that, but.
You hadn't had your son yet.
No, that was years before that. In fact, I had no exposure to children at all until my kid was born.
Oh, so you were really?
Yeah, just green, totally green. Well, so anyway, Galbraith is an interesting character too. Not to get too far off topic here, he's an economist that was Canadian-born and was a New Dealer in the 1930s, working for FDR. He just died a year ago, I believe, maybe a year and a half ago, and was my favorite nonfiction author because of his liberal politics that I agreed with. In fact, I'd say probably his writing shaped much of the way I believe. And so, I had a personal experience with Galbraith that I thought was pretty neat. Is there was a point where I was looking at all the works that he had on my shelf and said to myself, this guy's got to be getting into the 90s and he can't live forever. I think I should write him a letter and thank him. So I wrote him a letter to thank him about all the stuff that I had studied over the years. And he wrote back and on Harvard stationery, where he's a professor emeritus, and said that he had slipped and fallen on ice and had broken a bone and was in the hospital not doing well when he got my letter, and that kind of buoyed him up and made him feel better to hear that letter. So I saved my Galbraith letter and kept it. And there's an autobiography out about him where it talks about the fall and the time in the hospital. Of course, it doesn't have me in the story, but I see myself somewhere in the part of that chapter. But anyway, Galbraith says in his book, The Great Crash, that these things really, from 28 down through 33, collectively, these all work to make the crash turn into the depths of the Depression. To start with, the market itself was allowing a practice that's definitely illegal now called margin buying. Margin buying would be where one borrows money, buys stock, sits and waits for the value of the stock to appreciate, 6 months to a year, maybe even less, sell the stock, repay the loan, sit on the profit, or do it again. Use the profit and or new borrowed money to buy more stocks. And that most of the stock prices that had risen in the late 20s were due to this gambling rather than the real productive capability of companies.
That's illegal.
Extremely illegal. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that why Martha Stewart was
jailed? Yeah, but it's not even that. It's like something, she lied about something. She claimed she didn't have insider knowledge, and I believe her on that, but I think there was something else she did know, and she lied about that, so... So I don't think she's as guilty as we would like to think she is.
Is it illegal for a stockbroker, or that's illegal for anyone
in the public? My knowledge is anyone's is illegal to do that.
The
buying stock on borrowed funds. It's like, it's similar to making your down payment in a house completely on borrowed money. Like if you went over to Oklahoma to a loan shark and picked up about, you know, $10,000 somewhere, use that as supposedly real down payment money to get another loan in Arkansas house. But people do that a lot. But I mean, that's what's the rationale behind making that illegal? That's right. And if a lot of people lose a lot of asses, then the whole country is in real trouble. And that's what happened with the stock market, was that way too much gambling going on, built around the notion that the stock values would always appreciate. And there's a fundamental concept of the 20s that Americans naively believed that the business cycles that came and went every 30 years up and down, those panics, I think, that, well, I don't know if we've mentioned it, but in 1819, 1837, 57, 73, 93, and that 1908 when I was talking about, they did not ever materialize. There was almost like a 30-year pattern of business cycles up and down. So there was clearly time for another business cycle to go up and down, but the Americans felt that now that Wall Street, rather than Fleet Street in London, ran the world markets, that somehow the magic of America would prevent future downturns. And if they were, they would be small. So it was foolish not to get into the market and risk big because you miss out on the potential profits. And of course, the market correction, as they like to say, occurred and took everybody with it. Had it been based as the 1987 one, based on really real money invested, then it wouldn't have had the ricochet trigger effect that it had in 1929. But it's Galbraith puts it together, that the excessive speculation and margin buying has an impact on every other part of the economy. Because if you can't can't pay back your loan, then the bank goes under. And if the bank goes under, everybody associated with that goes under. And all the businesses that are now going to be unable to sell products to people who won't buy, they have to fire their workers. And there's this kind of like multiplier effect that kicks in and did so. And in fact, from 1929 to 1932, by 1932, one out of every four previously employable people, which is for the most part males, employable people, were out of work. And when I took a summer class at Stanford, the instructor mentioned that if you could picture filling up the Stanford football stadium, which is about 80,000 people, once a week, every Sunday, for 4 years straight, and tell those people that you're fired, that's the impact of what was happening to the American economy in those 4 years. And so that surely doesn't, there's no foundation, there was no middle class, that most of the wealth was at the top or artificially created on credit through the middle and bottom. And why was that such? It was because, as it says here at the end of 28 and again down at number 33, lack of government regulations. The excessive belief in laissez-faire in a non-regulated market. There was no Securities Exchange Commission to regulate market practices or FDIC to regulate banking practices. All was based on buccaneering capitalist risk, which could produce great highs but also allow great lows to take place. Other weaknesses in the economic picture, as 29 shows, is that, as already mentioned, a disproportionate concentration of wealth, high profits and low wages. But if you look at 31, this is something that really people should have sensibly been on top of, and that is businesses would overproduce and allow their inventories to build up to large stocks, and they should have seen that as 28 turns to 29, markets are dropping and not buying, that they should have been cutting back at that point rather than continually producing. So overproduction, overconfidence in a market that was already starting to dip created a climate of havoc when the market crash occurred. And as 30 shows, there was already an agricultural depression in place. So half the country was in economic hard times. It didn't take much for the rest of the country to follow. So that's a quick summary of 28 through 33. I don't think there's any test questions on that. There is probably one. The one test question would be, what was margin buying? And that is the buying of stock on credit. So Hoover's response as a president. We can probably guess that if he's a person who did not believe in the heavy hand of regulation or of taxing, and he was for partnerships with business, he was not going to be one that wanted to have a strong federal role. Hoover was one of the last of the old-time believers in pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, that the government that governs least governs best. Hoover's philosophy, and again, there's still people who believe like this, but this is the last person in that high of a level of power to think this way. Hoover's philosophy was that if the government intercedes even on a temporary basis to provide help or to provide relief, that what happens is the business cycle is extended so that when you're waiting for the natural upturn to come, it's not going to, because you've interrupted the cycles of free market capitalism and you just extend the time of the recession. So like a disease running its course, the best thing a government should do is tighten its belt and wait it out. And no one expected that the hard times of 29 and 30 would extend into 31 and 32. A through C shows essentially his thinking here. There was, actually, to be fair to Hoover, he did encourage and sign into law more federal programs and more federal spending to cope with the Depression than any previous president had dealt with any previous panic. So when we say he was opposed philosophically to helping, that's in parallel to what FDR would do later, if you compare that. There was a call for voluntary business and community relief measures, soup kitchens, private organizations, churches, Salvation Army facilities, things of this nature were considered to be a thousand points of light, is what Bush the Elder used to call it, turning to private charities rather than the federal role. And such as the same idea being expressed in item C here, this idea that laissez-faire market economics, local charities and state reliefs be the bulk of protection rather than federal involvement. Now, why would someone be, looking at how bad things were, why would someone be so opposed to letting the federal government take a greater role? you're really concerned about people in a hard situation like this, what's his philosophical position on this? And he cares because, you know, he cared in the food relief programs before this. There is that belief. It's like the Mellon tax cuts. It believes that if you protect the top, that market economics will generate growth. And if the government gets involved, you prevent that possibility from occurring. And a lot of it has to do with the belief that even if you could provide some temporary relief by federal involvement, when does it stop? Or does it become permanent? Do you end up having a people that's dependent permanently on socialism as opposed to market economics? And do you extend the power of the government far greater than the states, beyond what the Founding Fathers intended in the Constitution? Now, those may sound to us, except for a few hardcore capitalists, those sound like, you know, why worry about those problems? But that was a big concern about the endangerment of liberty and the destruction of free market capitalism and the permanent dependence of people upon government. Of course, I think when people reach a point where they're hungry and don't know where the next meal comes from for a long time, those kind of principles become quite secondary. Didn't care.
Well, the involvement he had before he was president might have caused the depression. Some people thought that it was successful.
Well, his success in the relationship between business and government got him elected president after being Commerce Secretary. I think what I should have said or meant to say was that people were so disappointed that if this is the economic wizard that brought the prosperity of the 20s, why couldn't he make the changes necessarily to fix the depression? And that if he was so doctrinaire as to stick to one ideological position, even in the face of all this growing unemployment and despair, that he must have been heartless. And that's, for those suffering, I'm sure they felt that way. You've heard the expression Hoovervilles and Hoover towns and Hoover blankets, etc., where the Hoover flag was the pocket pulled out empty, Hoover blankets and newspaper over somebody with no place to sleep. So all those kind of feelings are expressed and felt to those who suffered at the time. But looking back at it, he anguished over it a great deal and did actually increase the federal role beyond what he thought was safe. He felt like he was flirting way too much with socialism with what he did, which was so negligible in comparison to FDR. One of the main agencies created here, I see the three is missing. I have no idea what three was. I bet it was good. But anyway, one of the agencies he created was called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. This was a federal agency in which the federal government would give loans to businesses and or state and local governments for relief projects. The Reconstruction Finance Corporation. It is an agency that will continue to exist during the FDR's years. So, Reconstruction Finance Corporation. Loans to large businesses, cities, local governments, states, by the federal government, for the purpose of trying to invest this into job creation. Of course, each of these, the businesses, the cities, et cetera, would all owe the money and have to pay it back. Where it changes with FDR, when Franklin Roosevelt takes control of the Depression and uses the RFC also, they will change from loans to grants. And these grants will not just go to businesses or to cities, but they will go many times in the form of individual dole to people. And there is probably the fundamental difference. Whether it's a loan that should be paid back or whether it's a grant of money that's just distributed, that's one difference between FDR and Hoover. And the other is whether or not you give it to businesses to create jobs or if you give it directly to unemployed people to buy food, clothing, and shelter with. And that was what FDR advocated. Of course, Hoover would have opposed the second on the grounds that it makes people dependent and it doesn't generate any base of growth. One thing you can say about FDR's programs, which we'll get to a little later, is the way to come at this would be when we talked about trickle-down economics by Mellon and said that it was used in the Reagan years. Does anybody remember the nickname that was used? Besides trickle-down, what was the other nickname for Reaganomics? George Bush, the vice president for Reagan, who was at first in 1980 running to get the candidacy, called it voodoo economics to criticize Reagan, and then after he became Reagan's running mate, you didn't hear that phrase anymore, but out of him. But yes, in addition to voodoo economics and trickle-down economics, it had a third name, which the Reaganomics. It was also called Reaganomics. The one I'm looking for is supply-side economics. I don't know if you've heard that before. supply-side economics, meaning that you put the emphasis in the assistance to the businesses, the suppliers, the producers, and that generates growth. And that is a change over what FDR encouraged, which is called, well, he didn't call it this, but in essence it could be called demand-side economics. So giving relief to individual people, demand side, giving relief to businesses to generate jobs, supply side. And you can see ideologically where left and right or Democrat and Republicans came from on that. So those were the major differences between how the RFC was used. In 1932, the year of the election, Hoover's re-election, an event occurs which pretty well helps cook his loss. It involved World War I veterans who were due an early, or not early, but due a pension payment for their World War I service in 1939. But here they are, unemployed, many of them homeless, thinking that why wait till 1939? When our country needed us, we served. Now we need our country. They better provide for us. So these veterans organized from many parts of the country into a visit to Washington, D.C. with an effort of trying to put pressure on Congress to vote for early pension payment. 1932. And the waiting for Congress to vote became kind of an event also, as these veterans in many parts of the Capitol and across the river in Anacostia Flats camped out waiting for the news of Congress, but also hoping to try to generate public support for their cause. And when Congress voted, they rejected it and instead voted to offer money to those who needed it to get back home, which some took and went back home. Others did not because there was nowhere to go back to. So after the rejection of the bonus marchers' requests, or the bonus army's wishes, you have these unemployed, angry, frightened, worried military veterans with weapon skills camped out around your capital, the worst time of the economic picture in history. It's not a good image for stability of government. So Hoover wants to try to get this taken care of. He speaks with Douglas MacArthur, who we'll later know of World War II fame and the Korean War, who was chief of the Army at the time, and says to MacArthur, these are people, many of them, which served with you in World War I. Let's talk to these people and convince them to leave peacefully. And he expected exactly that, that MacArthur would go and dialogue with these people and try to smooth them over. And he gave instructions to MacArthur that only in a last-case scenario do you turn to force, if necessary. Well, MacArthur was disgusted with these people hanging around, didn't treat them as equals in respect because they were the homeless, the leftover. And so he, rather than dialoguing, MacArthur went right in with force and bulldozed down a lot of the shantytown area where they were living, threw tear gas in some places, resulted in the death of one child. That removed them. But you can well imagine the image in the papers that he gave, not so much to MacArthur, but to his boss, the Commander-in-Chief Hoover. That's Hoover's response to our veterans' needs in the worst time of economic history. So that really makes it extremely more difficult for Hoover to have any chance of winning the election of 32. So 1932's election, what a watershed year this is. Probably just about any Democrat, or as the expression used to be used years ago, any yellow dog Democrat, I would say, could get elected in 1932. But it wasn't just any Democrat. It was Franklin Roosevelt. And Roosevelt was a politician who came from traditional patrician background, like Theodore, admired his cousin Theodore a great deal, wanted to have the kind of rough and ready image that Theodore had, but he wasn't. He was just too much of a sophisticate. And he had been active in politics early. He'd been like Theodore Roosevelt, he was a Secretary of the Navy during World War I, like Roosevelt had been during the Spanish-American War. Ran, as we know, for Vice President in 1919. Active in New York local politics in the early 20s. Got involved in an affair with, what was her name? Oh, I used to know it. Anyway, it's a name I shouldn't forget. But got involved in an affair with a lady that worked closely with the family, which Eleanor discovered. And in the early 20s onward, if there was a romantic relationship that existed between Eleanor and Franklin was gone and over with, and the rest of their marriage was one that people try to paint the Clintons up as being, I don't know if that's fair or not, one of convenience and one of political closeness. And this lady that Franklin was involved with would later reappear in the end of his life, visiting the White House and seeing him in other places. And some say that Eleanor may have been helping cause this problem because she seemed to hold back her feelings and her attitude towards Franklin and visit the troops and visit the coal miners and visit factories. And lots of times she just wasn't there for him in those hard years of the end of World War II. But this other lady would show up, and it turns out their daughter would be the one that would kind of be the traffic cop to find out when Eleanor's gone so the other lady can come in. I wish I remember her name. I'll have it next time around. And in fact, when FDR passed away at Warm Springs, Georgia, with a brain aneurysm, she was there visiting him rather than Eleanor, so that wasn't a good end for that situation. And rumors circulate that Eleanor had maybe too close of a relationship with another woman named Elizabeth Hitchcock, and there's no proof to that, but there's lots of suspicions around. But Eleanor is remembered for being the first lady to be an activist and policymaker. She was way ahead of Franklin on such things as civil rights. That just blew me away. Let me recollect myself here. Civil rights legislation, of course, as I said, visiting the mines for a safety standard inspection, visited troops overseas. So she was really, again, the first lady to be an activist in promoting causes and policies. And lots of times, Franklin could use her as a weather vane to kind of figure out which way the mood of the country is going, let her go liberally way out on an end, and if it's like up the flagpole to see if it sold or not, or if it flew. That was her role, and there was a close relationship there, even if one that was romantically was long gone since the 20s. So, Roosevelt in the early 20s contracted what may have been polio. For years it was believed to be, but scientists look back now and say that polio usually hits the youth rather than the elderly, so it may have been some other disease that masked it closely. And that's why Roosevelt was always this, not the only reason, but one of the many reasons he was very sympathetic with the downtrodden because of his personal experience. He was on the face of a dime. Kind of an obvious question here. You know, Franklin Roosevelt, what's on the back? Besides the bundle of sticks that looks like some kind of fascist Roman magistrates. It's the symbol for the March of Dimes campaign, which was to deal with polio. And so that's what he was a promoter of that, and it's still there on the coin. And not to ever get off topic, but there was a movement to replace FDR on the dime a few years back. With whom? Reagan. And liberals like myself just got inflamed at the thought that FDR would be changed over for Reagan. But you know who fought against it and killed it? Nancy. She said that that's just not who should be removed from the coin. So that was an interesting.
Is he the one who
always
walked around in the Secret Service?
Yes. They would prop him up, fix up the braces so he could take a few steps forward, a few steps back, which was an excruciating pain when he did so. But that was for public appearances, especially when he appeared before Congress. He always wanted to be standing. But other than that, they would film it to where, like in a baseball stadium, he was going to throw out a pitch. They'd have it so the car drives up, and there's all these seeming needed Secret Service people that huddle around so that no one could see him fixing up the braces to stand him up. His greatest fear as a president was fire, being left alone upstairs in fire with no way to get out of it in the wheelchair. And there is also a controversy over the a memorial for FDR in Washington, D.C. I haven't seen it, but I think there's two. And one of them is obviously with the wheelchair showing, and this was not what he would have ever wanted in life, but the people, the Americans with disabilities, wanted that there to, in order to promote their cause. That's revisionist history. Well, the election, 1932 elections, where I should come back to. Hoover and FDR are the two candidates. FDR's running mate will be a Texas governor named Cactus Jack Garner, or John Nance Garner. Garner will serve twice for him as vice president, being elected in 32 and again in 36. He wanted to be the candidate and really expected to be the candidate, but was finally told that you just can't get elected. But you can earn electability if you serve two terms as a vice president. You can be the candidate in 40. So he accepted it on that grounds. Then when 1940 came along, what happens instead? FDR runs for a third term. my understanding is that he was asked about it, agonized over it for maybe as much as 17 minutes before he said yes, he would run. Dr. New Deal was now Dr. Win the War in 40. Well, Garner, when asked to be a third-term vice president, responded that the vice presidency was not worth a pitcher of warm spit and refused. So,
it's not worth the blood.
Pitcher of warm spit. That was his assessment of the office. So, and instead, Henry Wallace, who was the agriculture secretary, became the vice president. And while we're not on it, FDR ran for a fourth term in 1944. He shouldn't have, with his health the way it was. But Henry Wallace did not. Wallace was considered way too liberal, so who instead became the third vice president in the fourth term? Truman. And so therefore he was able to become president. Can you do that again? Can you run for three or four terms?
No.
Why not? By what amendment? Anybody know?
22?
Yep, 22nd Amendment. It's easier to remember two terms, 22nd. How do you feel about that amendment? Technically, it says you can serve as much as 10 years. Two full terms and 2 years of a vice presidency before you took office or won the election. Does that seem like a reasonable amendment? It is. Well, he would have wanted people to voluntarily not run. I don't know about the amendment part, but it's in the spirit of what... Yeah. It is. That's true. It is. So FDR had violated that tradition. Well, but think about it. If the people of America have more trust in George Bush than any other person, and he's proven that trust and can win that vote, why should people be denied the chance to democratically elect who they want? Doesn't that seem to deny us, the voters, our rights?
I think it protects us.
From ourselves. So it's a limitation of democracy in that sense. Would you go for term limits for House and Senate? Wow. I think that's probably the move that most people would have. Well, even if it meant another Reagan, I should watch what I say. I still think it should have been we had the choice to vote for who we want. Well, anyway, let's get back to getting him in office here. We already almost have him killed. 1932, he runs on a campaign called the New Deal, which will be best explained through the directions of relief, recovery, and reform. Relief will mean to provide jobs or just direct dole of money to the unemployed. Recovery will be measures to stimulate industry, farming, et cetera, to get the various directions of the economy going again. And recovery would work to get farming back on its feet, banking, manufacturing, etc. Measures to try to stimulate economic growth in each industry would be recovery. And reform would be to put laws on the books that would correct the kind of buccaneering capitalist image we talked about, bring things more safely in line to prevent future depressions. That's the question we asked earlier about why the 1987 stock market crash didn't result in a depression. The answer you gave is directly it, that the reform measures controlling banking and stock practices prevent that. So that's what he advocated when he ran for president. Now, he didn't have in mind all the New Deal laws of the 30s. He didn't have them laid out or calendarized or anything. He was an experimenter. One of the things he was willing to do was something rather than nothing, something new. And one thing for sure is, if the Democratic Party had been the party of laissez-faire since Andrew Jackson or even back to Jefferson, if you can chart it that way, this is the watershed change in the Democratic Party's history. It's the move away from laissez-faire politics to activism. A debate can be made as to whether or not these changes were evolutionary or revolutionary, but at the time, it's considered revolutionary to the opponents that lost the election. He also, in addition to all these spending and programs and job creations, he promised balanced budgets, as all politicians do. And it's hard to know how much he believed whether it could be done or not. It couldn't be done at this time. And it's at this point where I wanted to talk some about John Maynard Keynes. I brought an article that I wanted to share about this. And it's not such an article, it's an event. You're going to go off on a lot of personal opinions here, but talk a little bit about Keynesian economics and John Maynard Keynes. He's a British economist who, at the time of World War I, a London School of Economics graduate, who at the end of World War I went with the British delegation to the Versailles Conference, was an advisor to what came out of it, and then a great critic later. He argued that the way Versailles was established with its punishment of Germany would have a devastating economic effect on the new German Republic. It would fail. Extremism would probably come to power, and Europe would be in danger again. And of course, he's nailed it, had it all right. This is in his book called The Economic Consequences of Peace. And his criticisms were met with such discordance that throughout the 20s, it was hard for him to be accepted in high circles. But the 30s gives him a chance to rehabilitate, if you want to put it that way, because of the Depression. And what John Maynard Keynes, or Keynes, advocated in the 30s, finally in a book in 36 that you don't have to know the title of, called The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. Here's the Keynesian view of economics. Traditionally, governments, like families, cope with the Depression by tightening the belt, cutting back spending, and waiting for good times to come back. And he said, this is such a waste of the most important resource available, people. If you can get people back to work, stimulating economic growth, you can prime that pump and get that economy rolling again. So what a government should do is what a business does to expand and grow. A business doesn't wait and save up to finally buy a warehouse. They take out a loan. They expand the business that way, and then when they make enough profits, they pay back the loan and continue to grow in that fashion. So what Keynes is arguing is that governments should respond in hard times in a similar fashion, finding ways to get people back to work, trying to get money into the economy. And we can talk about that. How can a government get more money into an economy during a recessionary time? A couple of directions you can go. There's monetary and fiscal policy methods. Monetary policy would be lower the interest rates through the Federal Reserve System so banks can borrow more and we can borrow more. Or a more direct way, a fiscal policy way, would be just spend more and tax less. And that's what Keynes would argue. He argued for both, but he said that in emergency times, that kind of aggressive fiscal policy was the best. Spend more, tax less. So you get money into the economy. Of course, if you do that, what happens to the budget? Yeah, you have deficits that are eventually lead to high debt, which we still have. But don't blame it all on the Depression. There was a few wars in there along the way also. But Keynes also argued you can use this formula in reverse, that after the economy starts to get better, and in fact, if you get to the point where there's such high employment and inflation starts to run away, you can cool off a runaway economy by reversing the process. Tax more, spend less, take money out of circulation, and you can also raise the interest rates. His main point was that a government should be active in helping and regulating an economy rather than laying back and letting things wait for the business cycle. How do you feel about Keynesian economics as a theory? Think about it. If you have a way that you can forever regulate economic growth, there's no need for the business cycle. There's no need for depressions anymore. I mean, it is activist government, if you're bothered by that. But, well, there's a political downside to it. It works quite well politically during hard times. But what happens in good times when they say it's time to cut spending and raise your taxes? Yeah, you don't get reelected. So the downside of Keynesian economics is it's easy to spend, it's hard to tax. It's hard to use it in good times. Now, recently, and I didn't realize our guest was going to be with us here, but I'll just foolishly plow through with what I had to say anyway. Recently, a professor named Hans Hermann Hoppe, H-O-P-P-E, at the University of Las Vegas in Nevada, University of Nevada in Las Vegas, an Austrian economist, had made the comment, if I can summarize this correctly, that in terms of long-range investment thinking, gay people tend to not have long-range thinking. And what I left out of the story here is that Keynes was gay. married a Russian ballerina and put up pretenses, but he, most people knew. So he was attacking Keynesian economics on the argument that if gay people don't have long-range investment plans because they have less families and children, et cetera, they live more for the moment, that Keynes, as a gay person, came up with a formula that was short-range thinking that would lead to high deficits and irresponsible eventual bankruptcy for economies. And he got into trouble for making the comments, and there was a hoopla about it, and there was some disciplinary actions taken. But what's your reaction to that idea that could Keynes' homosexuality been a factor for causing him to come up with a short-range economic formula that in the long run leads to huge runaway debts? Well, my first argument against this...
Yeah,
we do. Well, yeah, and I think you're right that supply-side economics in a way is a use of Keynesian economics. But the two things I want to kind of say in regards to that is, and I may just put my foot in my mouth as I go, but let's say, for example, and I'm thinking on the spot, I should have thought before I got here, but let's say African-American males have a high rate of being arrested. We won't explain why, but let's say that, you know, that's where I'm going with this. And so therefore you say this black economist comes up with this formula that's going to cause these problems because he is black. I mean, that's... The stereotyping is extremely shallow, but even worse than that is this Austrian economist forgot his history. Who was the person at the Versailles Treaty that said the long-range consequences of the Versailles Treaty is going to be a wrecked economy in World War II? The gay guy. There's the person who saw the long-range consequences. And when asked about long-range consequences, Keynes is noted for having said, in the long run, we're all dead anyway. That's kind of his remark. And that reminds me of a scene from Annie. It's one of my favorite scenes from a musical. Don't watch any musicals. Everybody saw Annie, the movie, right? Okay. Do you remember the scene where Daddy Warbucks goes to visit Franklin Roosevelt and the helicopter lands on the lawn and they get out and the first thing Warbucks says to Roosevelt is, Franklin, you don't think your program's out in the long run? A reference to the Keynes comments. Anybody remember what Roosevelt's response was? People don't eat in the long run. My favorite part of that movie. So, anyway, back to number 7 here. So the FDR presidency is a successful victory. Democrats win majorities in both houses of Congress. It is a political realignment, the first of since 1896. And there will be more laws passed during the first 100 days than probably previously a decade passed in regards to regulating economic situations. Number 8 shows us two constitutional amendments that are ratified that year, the 20th and the 21st Amendment. The 20th Amendment is often nicknamed the lame duck amendment because it changed the inaugural dates. Not just for president, but also Congress. Originally, the Constitution designated what day for inauguration? Right. Now it's what? January 20th. And it has been January 20th ever since 1937, because that's the next chance they had a chance for it to be. So every president was inaugurated on January 20th. There's an exception, though. In 1985, who won the 84 election? Okay. Why would Reagan, in his re-coronation or re-inauguration, not be able to hold it on the 20th of January? What? That's it. The Super Bowl was more important than the Reagan inauguration. So the network said, if you want the coverage, you can do an official ceremony privately on Sunday, but Monday you better do the big ceremony for coverage. So it's been on January 20th ever since. But for Congress, here's the more interesting and more important point, is that it used to be that when elected to Congress in November, you took office that January right after it. No, I'm sorry, that's the way it is now. You would wait 13 months before you took office. Now it's moved up to just the 2.5 months.
Lame duck.
Okay, I'm sorry. The period between when someone is elected, or actually not elected, someone loses election or does not run and leaves office is known as the lame duck period. In fact, a lot of countries do not have lame duck periods for their executive. Why did we build in a transition period between election and office taking?
So people
so that the liberals all don't run off to Canada after losing an election? Possibly. I'm thinking two things. One is that the logistics of getting to the capital needed some time. But I think also, this is the more brilliant part of the plan, is that if you know you are likely to lose an election or do lose an election in the middle of putting together some important bills or negotiations or ratifying a treaty, why bother? Why not just shut down work for the week or two before the election? So this allows for a fluid movement of policy making, and it went well. But now then the next question is, if they created this long lame duck period, why shorten it? And why shorten it in 1933 especially? Much war is, what does it reflect in the people's desires if they want a quicker changeover? Depression is coping with the depression. The belief that there is a mandate given to this new administration, to this new party, to move and act and move fast. And which they did. The first 3 months is called the first 100 days, and they felt a sense of responsibility and burden on themselves to respond to the depression. When this recent Congress changed over to Democratic control in 2006, do you remember kind of a parallel slogan used? First 100 hours. They talked about how much legislation could they get done. I mean, it wasn't much they could do in 100 hours. But it was trying to recapture that idea of the Roosevelt victory, that the people have spoken for a massive change. And a lot of presidents following their election were kind of given that same yardstick to follow, that you have to show that you are capable and have an agenda ready within the first 3 months of office. I remember when Bush the Elder was elected in 1988, people were all over him for what will you do in the first 3 months, and he goes, probably nothing. And I said, why? Well, because my job is to maintain Reaganomics, not to change it. So my first 100 days should be maintenance. But the Second Amendment, the second one in 1933 we're going to talk about, was the repeal of Prohibition. Why might you think Prohibition was repealed in that year? Now, we talked some about Prohibition already earlier, didn't we? That's really what it is. The Democratic Party was never on board with Prohibition, in the North at least. It was always opposed to it. And the urban voters, the immigrant voters, et cetera, had wanted this change since the 20s, and so they reaped the rewards of that. But they wouldn't sell it that way. They wouldn't say, these Eastern European immigrants who like to drink a lot finally won an election. You wouldn't say that. Instead, they would say, why are they changing it? Generate jobs, generate economic growth. And it would, too. So these are just some of the first reflections of changes that occur. In fact, I think the first one came out and ratified in February. The second one was in place by March, but not ratified till December. But they had already started changing the laws and weakening the Volstead Act to sell 3.2 beer in response to that. Well, FDR's inaugural address. Going to the inauguration, if you see pictures of Hoover and FDR in the car as they travel, Hoover has got that exuberance and the cigarette holder straight up in the air and the gleam in his eye. And next to it's Hoover, who looks just like he's sick. And he wanted out of that quicker than anything else. And so there is that kind of symbolism of someone who seemed to have tired and had no answers to the Depression, Hoover, leaving office, and someone with the exuberance and enthusiasm taking over. His inaugural address is remembered for its dynamic wording. And this is the line that is best remembered. He says, "Let me assert the firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror which paralyzes needed efforts to turn retreat into advance." And so that doesn't introduce any program, but it introduces courage. And that's what he's remembered for. Other parts of the speech and include these lines. This is just some taken out here. "The money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization. We may now restore that temple to the ancient truths. This nation asks for action, and action now. and he warned that emergency measures might call for a temporary departure from the normal balance of the executive and legislative authority. Where is he hinting there? What's going on there with that argument about deviating from the normal balance of executive and legislative power? Yes, big executive power. And this is where historians do chart the growth. That from FDR onward, there is this stretching, expanding of a presidential executive power with popular support demanding it. In fact, probably one of the great criticisms of the Carter administration is that he just wasn't a strong enough, assertive enough president. He did not stretch the powers beyond the Constitution like people wanted him to, maybe. At least in coping with the problems he faced. But that starts with FDR. And people expected that and wanted that. That same kind of strength and confidence, but also relation to giving hope to people, kept going throughout his presidency through what media? On the radio, when he'd give speeches, sometimes twice a week, where he'd introduce a policy or he would just give encouragement and try to re-bolster people. What were the name of those radio programs? Yep, Fireside Chats. Carter tried Fireside Chats on TV too, but it never went over quite as well. And there was a Saturday Night Live skit where Dan Aykroyd played Carter talking down a person on a drug overdose in one of his TV Fireside Chats, and he knew everything about all the chemicals. I've seen that skit. The rest of the quote here, before I should have stopped here, was that I shall not evade the clear course of duty. I shall ask Congress for the remaining instrument to meet the crisis. Broad executive power to wage a war against the emergency as great as the power that would be given me if we are in fact invaded by a foreign foe. And he got it. And critics were upset about it too. But not just the presidential extension of power, but the extension of federal power itself over the states is much of the struggle of the New Deal. Well, the first crisis that FDR has to face upon taking office in March is a near total collapse of the banking system, which was on its way down in the first part of the year. 9/10 of the banks were on holidays that they had voluntarily engaged in. Depositors' confidence was shot. Many people had removed their funds from banks before they closed, and the classic belief that people were putting them under the mattress or burying them in the backyard. And if your banking system is gone, the capitalist system is gone. And so that's the first thing he had to face with. Calling special sessions of Congress on March 9th, they considered measures of what to do with the banks and put together a four-day bank holiday. And in that 4 days, inspectors examined as many banks as possible, authorized the reopening of sound ones, and kept closed the others so that people could start back to putting their money into the banks. By June of 1933, the banking industry gets even further support in item 16 on the next page. Sorry to jump forward on you like that.
Yeah, are we skipping everything?
Not skipping everything. We're just jumping over there because it's a banking-related law. Then we'll come back. The Glass-Steagall Act, or the creation of FDIC in June of 1933, is a more permanent measure of banking support. And this is a reform measure, but in a way also a recovery measure to stimulate growth. What does FDIC stand for? You see that on the banks a lot. Maybe if it's a savings and loan, you see FSLIC. Federal Deposits Insurance Corporation, government corporation. And the other one would be Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation. In the beginning, it would insure a deposit up to $10,000 if the bank closed. It later was changed to $20,000, $40,000, I think it's up to $100,000 now. Same for the federal savings and loan industry. Now let's say, just hypothetically, crisis occurs and everybody's fearful about running on the banks to get their money, but they don't, and all the banks collapse. Could people get all their deposits paid back by the federal government? It's actually not that hypothetical. There was a savings and loan scandal crisis in the 80s in which dealt with that. But if all the banks and all the savings and loans went under, could the government pay us back? I mean, it doesn't seem feasible. So what's the purpose here? To convince you that it is safe so you won't run on the bank, so that won't happen. So, So it's a psychological insurance program as much as it is a financial one. And banks have to behave themselves and follow proper lending standards in order to earn the FDIC protection, so that if you go to a bank that doesn't have FDIC, then you know the risks you're taking. So that's one of the great reform measures taken. And in the stock market, I'm kind of running out of order here, but the same was true in number 17 with the Securities Exchange Act, creating the Securities Exchange Commission, regulated the stock practices we'd mentioned earlier that were so reckless. But back up to the top of the sheet. 10 we did, now 11. In 1933, the year he takes office, there is a worldwide economic conference held in London. The bankers of Europe, especially of England, are deeply concerned about how to cope with this depression. And one of the ways they want to make sure that stays safe is currency stability and values. They don't want to see the gold standard abandoned. That's the purpose of the conference. But FDR already has it in mind to devaluate the dollar and the gold standard in order to help pay for his programs. And so while we visit the conference, we make no commitments. And in defiance of what they wish, FDR will devaluate the gold standard. And I know there's something that on here that I should have said that I overlooked it or left it off the sheet. Did I ever talk about the Holly Smoot tariff? I bet that's number three. No, here it is, two. I just skipped it. Never talked about it at all. Back to the first page, number two. The Smoot-Hawley or Holly Smoot tariff. That's back during the Hoover years. Sorry to get us mentally out of order here, but it's on the exam. And you can put yourself back into the frame of mind of the 20s. What was the last tariff we discussed? Had the ricochet effect on agriculture? The Europeans kind of took it as though we were trying to milk money out of them when they didn't want to pay back the war debts. Maybe I didn't lecture this one either. Ford and McCumber, ring any bell?
Okay, where are you?
Well, I'm just kind of flashing back at the moment. I'm trying to do number two by going back to 1922 and talking about the Ford and McCumber tariff, which was a high one, one of the highest for its times. How about just believe it happened, and then we'll leap back up to this one. Market crash occurs in 29. A year later, in 30, Congress passes this Holly Smoot tariff, which was the highest in history, well over 50% in many industries. In fact, to my knowledge, it's the last named tariff. I think after that, then the president just has reciprocal trade agreement powers. This tariff was, as all tariffs were supposed to be, in the minds of the Republican Party, protectionism, to keep money at home, generate economic growth rather than see money leak out to other countries. But economic historians look at this and say that probably it had a more negative effect than positive, because it helped stifle world trade and cause retaliatory tariffs elsewhere. So what should have been helping a worldwide economy grow was hurt by the Holly Smoot tariff. And some even go so far as to say, not showing their work in this math problem, the Holly Smoot tariff leads to Hitler and World War II. And to some degree, maybe there's a connection there, if it helped aggravate the German situation worse in the elections. Okay, back up to where we were. I hope we're not lost by that jumping about. In the 11A here, the first 100 days, I already mentioned that. But have you heard the expression alphabet soup legislation? Well, that's these New Deal laws, many of them that occur in these first 100 days, AAA, NRA, SEC, just tons of two- and three-lettered, four-lettered agencies also, which are all these measures being passed to provide relief, recovery, or reform. Critics also said these things passed so quickly because of a rubber-stamp Congress, a Congress that would not stand up to a president. Why not? So didn't we hear the same complaints in recent years that a rubber-stamp Congress gives Bush everything he wants? Is that so bad? Well, how did that come to be? I mean, how did a Congress and a presidency all end up in the hands, maybe in big majorities, in one party? Is that some kind of manipulation or conniving that took place? I think I've led us off in the wrong direction. The people, they're the responsibility. They voted for this, right? We voted for this recently. They voted for that in the 1930s. So maybe we need an amendment that says that it's not possible for the two houses to be in the hands of the same party. That's what I'm getting at, is that the critics would argue that Democrats extended and abused the power of Congress and the presidencies, but the same criticism has been launched at the Bush administration recently. And people always have the chance to make changes. They did then, they do now, et cetera. Here's the 11B. I already talked about that. Before we stop, let's re-examine what we have left to deal with here. We've got three nights, is that right? And two pages, which I think we can make it in that. So, how about a quiz? Next time around, a quiz? Well, wouldn't it be cool if it went all the way back to the start of all this? How about, here's how I'll make the quiz. I'll start with the last item we did, 11B. Maybe pick on 16 also. And go backwards and just start making questions backwards and go back as far in history as I need to backwards until I get enough for bonuses.
Go backwards
to whatever. So it'll... Yeah, take us back before the election, into the 20s, maybe into World War One, that kind of thing, the Versailles stuff. Try my best to word the questions similar to the test questions so it reinforces the knowledge you need to know. Is that agreeable? Okay, so quiz on everything we've done up to this point since the last testing period when we come back, and then back to notes. Yes. Well, just count 13 proper nouns back and you've got the quiz. Yes.